Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review and stick the podcast up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to, hopefully enjoy. And it's a good job there's no set schedule because it's been a month since I last did this, which is almost entirely my fault. But I'm pleased that I put off this book because I've got a special guest on this episode to talk to about Ian M. Banks and his latest culture series novel called The Hydrogen Sonata. I have my identical twin brother, Nathan. Hi, Nathan.
Hello there.
And I'm sorry if this Skype quality isn't as high as we normally have the audio quality, but this is what we've got and we'll have to stick with it. So, Nathan, why don't you just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your reading, your science fiction credentials, let me put it that way.
My science fiction credentials. Well, I've been reading science fiction probably for as long as you have, Luke, though I've not read probably a quarter of the amount that you have in the last few years, because whereas you have a job where you travel around and have lots of time off, I have a job and family and everything like that. So my reading at the moment is mostly reduced to audiobook and fiction as well, so that's what I've been reading a lot. But over the years I've read loads of science fiction from the golden age and pre-golden age science fiction. I collect Isaac Asimov books, so I have all Isaac Asimov fiction now, just about, apart from some of his Nobby the Elf stories or whatever they are, but I have all his science fiction and most of his other fiction as well, and got quite a big library at home.
That's cool. If you could just back off the microphone slightly, there's a little bit of distortion. What have you been up to? What have you been reading recently? You said some of these podcast series that you're doing.
Well, I've got an audio subscription, an Audible subscription.
Yeah.
So I've been doing a lot of those books, and I've just got into reading or listening to some Stephen King books as well. So I've done the first of The Dark Tower and his longer ones. And most recent one is I think it's 1969 or something. No, 1964. It's about somebody going back in time accidentally and trying to prevent the Kennedy assassination from happening, which is a really good story, and it ends quite well. And in his acknowledgements at the end, he says that his son, Stephen King's son, came up with the ending for that story. So I think Stephen King's son should do that from now on.
Is that the son who is an author in his own right? Was it Joe King or whatever his name is? No, maybe not Joe King, but it's something like that, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know, but a couple of Stephen King stories, like Under the Dome, the endings have been pretty weak, although the characterization, everything has been brilliant. Whereas this one, the Kennedy assassination one, was really good and had a really strong, emotionally impactful ending.
So, and is it good science fiction?
Yes, it is. The time travel, the way of doing time travel, every time he goes back, there's only one way to go back in time, and you always go back in time to the same place. And the idea is that every time you go back in time, you can change something, but the very next time you go back in time, it all resets. So nothing that you did on the last trip is therefore real again in the present when you get back to the present.
Yeah.
Only what you did on the last trip has affected the present, but every other trip beforehand.
Oh, I see. So is not. Yeah, it's like a reset.
This isn't giving anything away, but it starts in a diner, and the person who owns the diner has been going back in time to the same butcher and buying the same 10 pounds of mince and serving it in his diner for 30 years or something crazy like that. Because he just goes back every week to get more supplies for his diet.
Wow, that has implications for conservation of energy and matter. I don't even want to.
Well, yes, exactly. So the mechanics of it isn't really explored. I mean, how it works.
The rules are set. The technology isn't. Is that what you said?
The rules are set. The technology isn't. Yes.
Yeah. One of the early science fiction book review podcasts. I think it was like episode 10 or something. Oh yeah, here it is. David Evans, episode 16, Time Station Berlin. I think the single lowest rating of any book that I completed, actually finished reading and read and reviewed. It's and that was set in When Kennedy was in Berlin and there was an assassination mm-hmm. attempt on Kennedy when he was in Berlin, and a time travel guy went back and stopped it. So it's funny that, you know, going back in time and stopping a Kennedy assassination, that was actually trying to stop the real one, and this was trying to stop a fictional one. Or maybe there was an assassination attempt then, which was stopped by time travelers, we don't know. Anyway, so I think if you're going to do time travel, Kennedy assassination book, read this Stephen King one rather than Time Station Berlin. Anyway, so, and you said before, we were just chatting online on Skype before, and you mentioned that some audiobook that you listen to is in podcast form. So you've been listening to, do you listen to these like all in one go, or do you like listen to them as they come out on like an episode by episode
basis? Well, there's a few audiobooks that I'm really podcast audiobooks which I'm really into, which are current at the moment. One is the Scott Sigler's Galactic Football League series with the starter, which you not with the starter, you reviewed the Rookie. I don't know how many episodes ago. It's a long time ago now, and I caught up with all of those, and then I've been listening to the last couple of episodes live, as it were, if you listen to them live or as they're being published.
Yeah.
That's good science fiction. I'm also listening to a zombie one called We're Alive, which is, if you want to catch up with that live, you've got until this week, because the hour-long finale, I think, is coming out this Thursday, because they're doing a live recording. They did it at Comic-Con or something like that. Anyway, at one of these conventions.
That one's been
really good.
Will that be a full cast one? Is that like with a cast of people and they're doing that live?
The whole thing is done with a full cast, so it's like an old-fashioned radio drama. Hmm. It's not an audiobook at all. It is an old-fashioned. It is like that classic kind of radio drama thing with a lot of good effects, and they have a really good cast. It seems to be a really good cast. I think they're all, you know, budding actors, but the people who've written it and produced it is, you know, are very good. And finally, what's the other one?
You said it was the Nathan Lowell, is it? Have I pronounced the name?
Yeah, he's got some that are coming out. I think all of these. Well, I'll talk to you about Nathan Lowell. Nathan Lowell, Lovell.
Lovell? Oh, okay. I can't remember seeing his name. You sent me a link before, but I restarted my computer since then, so I've lost that link. Let me have a look.
Yeah. Hang on, about the author, I've got his webpage up here. Lowell, it's Lowell.
Yeah.
Nathan Lowell, and he's a science fiction author. It looks like he's been writing for years and years. And a few years ago, he started this series called which starts with Quarter Share and goes on to Half Share, Full Share, Double Share, Captain Share, and Owner Share. And it's about, the names come from about the payment out of the profits that of certain solar clippers get. It's set in a galaxy where there's many, many planets. Some have surpluses of certain things and not of other things. So these clippers go between the stars, shipping goods around, you know, just basic supply and demand stuff. But this young lad, to get off planet, he becomes just a, I don't know, just basically, you know, like a deck scrubbing boy on a ship. And so he gets a quarter share of the profits of each trip.
Mm.
And then each season of podcasts then track his career as he goes up in the world, and in the end he becomes a captain of a ship and then an owner of the ship anymore. And I'm not giving anything away there. That's the point. That's the progression. And it's a bit like the Galactic Football League series in that way, where you start off someone who's at the bottom of their career, and you track them series by series as they progress through their career. And I like that. It works as a podcast. It would never work as a written novel, like all one book, I don't think, because each section, although he sells them as books, I think the podcast form is really well suited for it, for that kind of career progression and how the characters develop over time and how love interests come in and out and how you know, tragedy and whatever strikes their lives and how they deal with it. I think it's perfectly suited for podcasts.
And how long is each? I mean, there's like half hour episodes or something. How many of them?
I don't know. I've forgotten now. It's been a while. I've also been reading something else set in that universe, which is set on a planet, which is called. I can't find the name of it. I think it's South Coast Tales, and that's his most recent one.
Okay.
And it kind of ties in with that. Another science fiction one, but based on this kind of supply and demand, but on the planet side of it. And I think he's got more stories planned, and he's going to be releasing those over the next year. But Nathan Lowell is a great author. He's a great narrator as well. I can't really describe his style, but his voice is wonderful. And there's other stories that he narrates that you can find on podiobooks.com. And the Hidden Institute is one of them, which I've just finished reading. That's a fantasy podcast audio book as well.
Good stuff. And that's kind of because it's good that you like this kind of science, like a space opera kind of world that you can. And that's the great thing about these things is that you can tell lots of different stories. Like there's these guys having adventures on ships over there, but across on this planet, you know. And that's a good thing about these like widespread worlds. Oh, I just looked. He's called Ishmael Horatio Wang. I get the Ishmael reference and the Horatio reference, but I'm not sure where the Wang comes from. With Ishmael from the Moby Dick and Horatio as a Horatio Hornblower. It's another one of these guys who you know go to sea, and there's a you know the Clippers and stuff like that. So, but Wang, I'm not sure whether maybe that's a reference that I'm not getting, or maybe that's the future one. But yeah. With a name like Ishmael Horatio, you're gonna be a sea captain or some kind of captain.
You know the what's this Honor Harrington book?
Yeah.
Which reviewed very badly, and I've tried to read some of it.
I didn't review it badly. I gave it a bad review. I don't care.
Yeah, and so that's based on this kind of old, you know, the sea battles and things.
Yeah.
Which he kind of has to make up lots of rules to make sense as why you would set this kind of seafaring adventure in space. It really makes sense. Whereas with what Nathan Lowell does, he kind of just calls it, like they're called solar clippers, and he kind of says, you know, they try and find the best kind of trade winds, as it were, you know, the best routes between planets, and they try to find the ships, and of course it kind of turns out to like the big old tea clippers, which used to, you know, the cutty sark and stuff, which used to zoom around and you have those adventures on, but it doesn't feel forced in any way. So I wouldn't compare it to Honor Harrington in that way.
Yeah. Okay then. Well, my book update goes as such. The reason why I've not done some episodes is because this was, I guess, the first book that I read in this period where I've not been doing much reviewing. But then Juliana, my girlfriend, for all the people who don't know her, who are listening, she appeared on the Hyperion review that I did, and she had also started reading this book that we're going to be reviewing today, The Hydrogen Sonata, but she didn't get into that so much because then we got distracted with Dune, and she was reading that. And then as she was reading Dune, we were sat down like a week and a half ago to do a recording of her podcast. And then it turns out that the Dune that she had was the first edition German translation, and it was an abridged version, like half of the book had been cut out. So now she's reading it again in English, so we can actually discuss the book properly, because all the interesting scenes that I said, oh, and make sure you concentrate on this scene, because that's one of the key scenes that I want to talk about, and it was just missing from the book. I started killing people, but then I realized that I only had one of the sections on this last trip with me. I hadn't downloaded the other sections. I read Tarzan, or listened to the audiobook of Tarzan, which I did on the SFF audio. What else? And then another book, which is actually a little omnibus of two books. And I read the first one, and I thought, well, I'll wait until I read the second in this little omnibus of two books until I get on with it. So I've got like another three books that I should be getting to. But if you wanted an update or why I haven't been doing the podcast, there's a few little excuses there. And also, I've been super busy with travels. I've just finished making a video, which is a video of all the countries that I visited in the last 4 years. I've just uploaded that. It's on is on YouTube.
Did you go with my suggested edit?
No, I didn't. I just left it as it was. I'm uploading the 10-minute version with all the clips. So if anybody actually wants to make a different version, all the clips are there. Anyway, so yeah, it's the International Juggler 2012 edition, and like you say, I'm uploading a full version which takes like 10 minutes to watch, but is all of the clips that I've got in all the different places. That was I'll start uploading it this evening. What else have I been doing? Yeah, I've almost finished my Groundhog Day musical that I've been writing this year. I've got one song left to write on that, and just lots of other projects. So it's been, 15 minutes already? So let's get into the book, shall we?
So the book is The Hydrogen Sonata by Ian M. Banks.
Now, how much do we need to talk about the culture? Because I've talked about this a few times before on the podcast, because I've, if I actually quickly look at the book list here, I've reviewed by Ian M. Banks. I've reviewed Matter and Surface Detail and Use of Weapons and Transition, although that's not a culture novel. But these other ones, we've talked about the culture. If you don't know what the culture is, really, go and start off. What would you say is the first culture book? I think like Player of Games is probably the best introduction. And then you can go to... what would you say? There's a few of these.
I don't know. I can't really work out which is first. I read them completely out of order.
Yeah, me too as well.
Over the past 5 or 6 years. So my favourite, I really like Matter. I really like Use of Weapons.
Yep, Use of Weapons is, I think, the best book as a book. But I think some of the other ones are better books as...
What was the one about fighting in heaven and hell?
What's that, sorry?
That was Surface Detail.
Surface Detail was the last one.
I did like Surface Detail, but I told you this at the time, the performance of the reader of that book was so good. I couldn't work out if I was enjoying it so much because the book was so good, or if if the reading of it was the performance of it was so good. And thinking back of it afterwards, I kind of thought of holes which I would have liked not to have been there, but I didn't notice them at the time while I was listening to it. So,
yeah, I had the same experience with this. Is it Peter? Let me have a look here. So if I type in Audible and what's this one? Surface Details. Peter Kenny. So you said this same thing to me. Right. You said, "Oh, I listened to Surface Detail, and the narration is so good that you should probably not read it and actually listen to the book." And after reading it, I agree with you. There was a huge amount of variety in the narration and in the language, in the, you know, the different accents that he was using. He had a real great range there, and made it a lot of fun. And so when this book came out, I could have. Just once again bought the book or as an ebook or something, but I thought, no, I'll wait for it to come out on Audible. And once it did, and I saw it was by Peter Kenny again, I was like, yep, that was a good thing to wait for. So just to start off with the review of this then, the same thing, did you listen to this as an audiobook?
Yeah, I listened to this. Like, literally, I think it was it was out for 3 days. I saw it in the Audible update email that I got, and I waited 3 days and then spent my credit on, you know, like the very next credit that came in 3 days later. So it was probably, and listened to it all in just a couple of days. So,
yeah.
I really liked it. I wanted to refer back to with the Surface Detail one, that was about that, like, about heaven and hell and the afterlife as not a human organized thing, but like as a species organized experience. And this is similar because it's about what's called subliming, where a whole race decides to exit the matter, kind of material, four-dimensional existence, and travel into this, what do you call it, like this, you know, extra-dimensional subliming thing, but they have to do it as an entire culture or civilization.
Well, I'm not sure
and
that's true.
I think
true.
It contrasted very well between the Surface Detail book and this one.
Yeah, I think it's actually, they say that some ships can go by themselves. So I'm not sure if they can go by themselves only if the rest of the society or the rest of the culture is going to come along with them. But it's the technology, or how they go into this 11-dimension space.
I think it's the size of the mind, that the volume of mind. an individual from a society is sublime. They just get lost in the that next level of dimension.
Oh, but yes, I think
a ship's mind is so large that if a ship sublimes, it can survive independently and then also come back very occasionally as well. But the process of subliming changes the mind so drastically that unless the whole society goes together, they become disassociated. And also, if a ship mind goes in and comes back again, the ship mind is also... it doesn't bear a huge amount of resemblance to what it was before it sublimed. Anyway, but that's getting into the themes. Do you want to set up the story a bit first?
We've got.
I was wanting to talk culture, but a different society, starfaring culture, haven't we?
Yeah. So you got the Gazilt, and the Gazilt were around when the culture was set up 10,000 years, because this is actually set, you know, later than all the other culture books by, you know, say another few hundred years or however long he skips forward like that. So the Gazilt were around when the culture got set up, and they were going to be part of the culture. They were one of the founding member species of the culture, but then at the last minute they're like, actually, no, we'll do our own thing. So they do. And the culture does its own thing, and then the Gazilt is like, actually, I think it's around about, we don't have anything more to contribute to the greater society, we don't have anything more to contribute to, you know, to this or that, or whatever, you know, whatever is they decide as a species, as a whole race, as a star civilization, that they don't have much more to do, and they're like, well, let's do it, let's do what all these other species do, let's head into the 11th dimension, or into 11... dimension space or whatever it is that the sublime is, because nobody can really describe what it's like, but everyone, all the messages and all the reports that you get back say it's awesome, so let's go.
And the setup for this is why the Gazilt is subliming so early, because most species go a lot longer than 10,000 years, is because they, before they developed starfaring and technology, they were given like a set of books with prophecies in. And these prophecies kept on coming true and being very accurate. So by the time that they became a starfaring race, the religion is almost like it has been tested and it's passed kind of scientific tests. And so everybody just assumes it's true and believes it. And therefore, when they come to a point in society where they're willing to sublime because of this background of religion a lot sooner than most of the species do.
Yeah, it's not so much that this holy book has got prophecies in it, it says, oh, and in the stars are in here, and hidden behind this galaxy is that galaxy. Oh, you know, it's got secrets which would never have been available at the time. I don't think as much as prophecies, but it's like in the Bible where it says, you know, you look to the four corners of the earth, and you're like, that doesn't actually have four corners.
Not
and
quite.
The stars in this and the. And it's,
yeah, what
it's,
I mean is by prophecy, I don't mean foretelling. I mean, I mean kind of just. Explaining the world, but the explaining isn't clear until the scientific discovery gets made, and then they realize, oh no, this has been true all along.
Yeah.
What I mean by scientific testable is that it's able to predict things, and so they believe it. So that's kind of the setup for the story.
So
you've got a race, you've got the Gazilt, which is in a certain volume of space. As a whole society, they've decided to sublime.
But don't you think that another reason why they want to sublime is kind of to get there before the culture? They've got some kind of inter-culture or inter-civilization kind of rivalry going on there. It's like, oh yeah, we're ready already, you guys, we're going, but, you know, that kind of thing. It seems a little bit like that.
I would think so. There's some kind of proud, yeah, that we're sublime first, but it also seems to be tied up in certain individuals in the hierarchy of the Gazilt, because their hierarchy is like a military, so you've got kind of generals and admirals and things all the way down to privates and, you know, first class and whatever privates. Everybody in the society is militarized and it's organized that way. And it seems like the top brass in this society, there's a couple of people who want to be the people who take the society into sublimation.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like it's also they want the glory of encouraging the entire race to sublime. And if they don't do it during their lifetimes, they're going to miss out. So it almost looks like it's rushed forward just on the ambitions of a couple of people as well.
Yeah. What's the name of one of the main? There's the guy who is kind of like the Would you say he's like the main, like the main antagonist or the main bad guy or something like that? I can't remember his name because it was like a month ago when I listened to this one. Oh no, actually, did I make his? No, I can't find any notes here. Anyway, so he.
It was a month. It came out on 4th of October in the UK.
Yeah.
And I think I finished it before it came out in the USA on the 9th of October.
Yeah, in Germany it came out about the same time as in America because I saw that you had already. I think you mentioned it already. So so what happens is you get this guy who is let's just call him the commander. He's like third in line, isn't he, in this military gazelle society? And he's like, right. There's people who are going to come here to take over all the shit that we're leaving behind. Someone's got to look after
us. Yeah, the scavengers.
And he's kind of promised it to somebody. And what was the reason? Because it's like, oh, I'll promise it to you, and then you'll name the star after me.
Yeah, he
wants
the planet and the sun named after him by the scavenger species who are coming in later.
So what happens is that you can look at this and you go, wow, they're going to heaven. And this brings it back to the thematic kind of part of it again. And it's like, they're going into heaven, but these people aren't good people. This is like the real heaven. You're going into a place called the sublime, you know, you're going from the mundane to the sublime. But you don't get there by being good in a way. I guess the way that you can, your society can survive that long is by being good, is by being not evil and all of that kind of stuff. But the way that you actually get there is more to do with, you know, technological and, society progressing in some ways. And like you say, even if the heart of this civilization is a little bit rotten with all of the intrigue going on there, so that's one thing to think about, like in a thematic. Maybe we'll get more to that later. So you said before about the. I don't want to do too many spoilers here, but you said, oh, and then at the end it kind of just ends, and you didn't want it to end in that way. You want to talk about the ending?
I think some of the like not giving away the ending, but the ending of Surface Detail, there was a very all the characters are working towards their different ends, and by the end of it, there was like a big ending. Now in this one, it's
wait a second, you can't say by the end of it there was a big ending. Do you mean at the end everybody was going for their own goal?
No, but by the time you got to the end, couple of chapters, it had built up, and there was a ending, and there was going to be a resolution. But you don't know which way the resolution's going to go. You don't know if this person's going to get out of hell, or if hell was going to exist anymore, or the people were going to change. You know, there was all these different issues. In this one, it's kind of set up. You've got this strong female lead, obviously, who goes on a quest. Kossant, is her name, and she goes on this quest. But all the time you're thinking, well, what is this quest actually going to achieve? I couldn't work out what the quest was actually going to achieve in the end. And then when it got to the end of the book, although the ending was very satisfying, it was a good ending. A lot of the story and a lot of the plotting beforehand didn't seem to have much of a consequence on the end of the book.
But all the way through the book, the ship mines, and this is what I really thought was really like interesting and like experimental and quite daring in such a book. Of course, it's not daring if you've got like if you're like a multiple award-winning millionaire author who could put out any book with the name Culture on it and it sells massively. So it's not daring in that kind of way. But I really quite like the idea of it being, it's like, okay, so all of the ships are going, like, we've got this mission, and it could turn out to be nothing, but it could be really, really important. And all of the other books that he's written in the Culture series about, you know, them getting together and sending someone out, and they're going off, and it's like, yeah, we've got this thing, it's really important. Like, you get the in Player of Games and Use of Weapons, and I guess, is it Obsession, which is the biggest one, because something is coming through from a different galaxy, no, from a different a different realm or something, and this is a massive thing, and it's like all of the Culture ships have to work together, and it's going to be this massive thing. In Look to Windward, you've got, you know, a similar kind of thing. It could be the destruction
which
of entire.
Which is the one where there's the hollow planet with different levels in, which
oh, that's
like
matter
that kind of
as well.
Fantasy element to it.
Yeah, matter, and you're thinking, okay, we're going to go on this thing, and it's going to be really important. Yeah. And all the time you're going, well, it could be important, but it might not be that important. And I really like in this book, whereas all the ships are going, look, we don't know if this is going to be important or not. Does everyone want to do this? And they're like, yeah, well, if you guys do it, I'll do it. And I'm not even using like more colloquial language because that's how these guys chat about it. It's like, look, are we really going to do this? You can back out now if you want. And everyone's like, yeah, okay, let's better safe than sorry. Let's go in and do this. So when you actually get to the end of the book.
That's what I mean. It's like the whole time everybody's kind of wondering, is this going to happen or is it not going to happen? Well, if it doesn't happen with this, and if this happens, it doesn't need to happen. But in the end, no, I'm not going to give away the ending. I don't want to give away the ending.
But I think I've pretty much kind of spoiled it in a bit, is that the big mission that they're going on to fight, that the thing that they're looking for and all this kind of stuff, that it might really be important, and this could be that and that could be that. In the end, it turns out that what the culture minds have been going after turns out not to be the most important thing. And I can understand how people go, oh, that's really disappointing. But he was setting up all the way through the book that this is not a clear case of, hey, the culture is against hell and these other people are for hell. Well, of course hell is bad, so let's stop hell. It's like the culture is against this war happening and these other people are for this war happening, so let's stop that, and that's great. And you know, in Player of Games, it's like, well, this culture is a really bad one, the one they live out in the Lesser Magellanic Cloud or whatever it is out there, and they go, well, it's, you know, they're out there and they're taking over this place and they're holding it and they're torturing people and it's really bad and we want to put a stop to that. And you're like, yes, that's good. Even if you think that the way that culture and contact and special circumstances, the way they do it is morally ambiguous, to say at the best.
Yeah, but with this one though, it's like there's a group of ships which kind of accidentally see something and get involved and start investigating and then helping out Coruscant from the thing. But it's almost like a couple of them are literally, you know, like they have in films where there's the halfway point where they all have to convince each other to work towards the end.
Yes.
There's almost a point like this where all the ships are communicating together and they're saying, are we actually going to do this then or not? Or, you know, are we going to ask for more ships to come over and help us, or are we just going to wait for it to play out a bit more? Yeah. And I like that. It seemed to be that the ships were a little less powerful compared to the people that they were dealing with and dealing with events than in other culture novels where the culture is meeting other space races.
Well, that's what you had in Matter. You had that other civilization where there's more people in this. There was more people around this one star in this other civilization that exists in the entire culture. And you see that now.
Big water filled kind of arms swirling around, kind of.
And they go down these pipes, and you get that there. And you realize, oh wow, if the culture went up against there, they might not do so well. And here you have that kind of thing where you get the ships that are coming in, and I really love those. I can't remember what the kind of the name of these people, but they had these ships which always dance, and they do a dance with their ships to get anywhere.
That's one of the scavenger species.
Yes, that are coming in, and they're like, okay, we're going to do this dance, and there's a culture ship who's going along with them, kind of like checking out, you know, making sure they don't do anything. So, and then he's like, oh, guys, you're taking far too long. Tell you what, I'll do a special, you know, quote unquote, dance with you. And he sort of ferries them all super quickly across there. But the way these ships are dancing in and out, you really realize that the culture ships are so far ahead of these. But then going up against the Gazilt, who are kind of at the same level, you think slightly below the same level, below the level of the culture. But because this isn't the entire culture, this is kind of this little group which isn't contact and it isn't special circumstances. It's just these group of old ships, these old eccentric ships going, hey, look over here. Should we help out? Are we helping? Do you think we're helping or harming? And you can see them all going, what? And they kind of, some of them, you know, they don't do, you know, when they're going up against the Gazilt, you just realize, oh, this isn't the culture meeting its match, but it is some ship minds meeting their match in this case.
Yeah, yeah. But coming back from ships, there's a few big dumb objects in this book, which I just wanted to mention. The first big dumb object is the Gazilt civilization is based around a city, which is like a band, 50 kilometers high and 20 kilometers wide, which goes around the entirety of the planet. Which I thought was it's a good little twist on the kind of like almost like a ring world kind of thing, the concept. But the gazelles have never filled this planet, and like 95% of it just stands empty because it's a relic left over from a previous culture, a previous, civilization.
Yeah. It says they've added to it. The other one that I really, really love, which you get kind of get the similar kind of thing between both of these, is the moon, where they have, and there's all these like big grooves on the moon, and there's no atmosphere on this moon because it's like our, like lunar, it's like our Earth's moon. But
they've
deorbited
an asteroid.
Yes, which goes down one of the, because this old civilization has carved out all these channels all around it in this like maze-like pattern. But there's one which goes all the way around the equator. Anyway, it's a big circle. So if you're going to orbit around it, so what they did, they orbited a ship around it and then brought it lower and lower and lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. So it's actually now orbiting inside the diameter of the, you know, the length of this orbit is actually smaller than the wider circumference of the moon itself, let me put it that way.
It wasn't just a ship though, it's like an asteroid turned into a ship, so
yes.
It's not just a few hundred meters long, it's a couple of kilometers across kind of thing, and it's orbiting inside the, below the surface of the planet, which is very cool.
But so that is kind of played out again with this orbiting ship in this what do they call it, this big wall city that goes around the equator, and inside there you also have airships that go around the inside of this city, you know, orbiting around the inside.
Yes,
so it's...
but they don't whip round in a couple of hours. Like 5 years to circumnavigate the city, to go around the entire world.
But I'm just saying, this is obviously something that this culture likes, or maybe that Ian M. Banks has put into this book, like these two different things in this one book. I mean, I've seen him do this similar things before, like for example in what was the first Consider Phlebas, which is his first book. He crashes a big ship, and then there's another book called of his, not a science fiction book, I think it's called The Business, and I think in The Business he also crashes a big ship. So there's some things which I think appeal to him, and for him to put two orbiting things inside, they're both orbiting, but one's not really in orbit, it's just circumnavigation. There is some really fun technology and some really fun remnant the civilizations, or is the remnants is the people who are left over after a civilization sublimes, and there's some people who don't sublime, they're called the remnanters anyway.
Object. Yeah. It's not dumb. It's actually a ship. I don't think we've met one of these before, but I think, is it the Galaxy class or Empire class ship turns up at the end, which is like the largest of culture ships. There's largest class of culture ships, and it's just it's huge. It doesn't just travel on a whim. It has to kind of plan out where it's going a few years in advance to give everybody notice, because it has like 19 billion people living on this one ship. But it's not a ship as it doesn't have physical walls. It's all just force fields. So it has like all these little worldlets and things. But they all look like they're open to space, but it's all just encased in force fields. And yet it's not a big dumb object, because it's very much alive, and it has a ship mind, like this awesomely large ship mind, which is almost godlike in its power within itself.
Yeah, it's the system class GSV empiricist. It says here on the Wikipedia page of List of Spacecraft in the Culture Series, it says, described as being big even by the standards of system class ships. And it actually has, you know, like all of these have got... it's got ships on board the ships, then they do stuff around. So this is a good idea. What was your favourite ship name in this book?
Well, I'm not going to give away Mistake Knot's full name, because that's at the end, and it's too... I can't remember it anyway.
Yeah.
I can... I don't know. I've not got a list of the ships. I like the ships... To be honest, the names of the ships in the culture, I kind of forget them about as a name, and I just come to think of them as the ship which does this with this kind of attitude.
Yeah.
It's like saying, "What's your favourite character name in Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit or something?"
Yeah.
It's not really the name; it's the characters behind it. And
I think for me, there was there's some good ones, like the value judgment, the Kakistocrat. The Kakanim, But I think my favorite one, which I actually kind of giggled slightly at every time it was mentioned, is just the washing instruction chip in life's rich tapestry.
Tapestry,
Yeah,
yes, I love
but this.
that. Sometimes it was abbreviated to rich tapestry,
Yeah.
or I think, and then other times just the chip or something. If you just have the tapestry, it sounds quite poetic. But then when you have just like this random thing,
Yeah.
it sounds a bit more flippant. But what I did like about all these ships is none of them were proper warships, although they all had weapons, and they were outclassed a lot of the time, and some of the ships don't make it to the end of the end of the novel.
Yes, I was going, that's what I was mentioning before. They kind of meet their match here, but they only meet their match because they're like ex-thug and ex-psychopath class. There's the I love this one. It's called the rapid random response unit, the troublemaker class, and these things. No, and the smile to oh, the warm considering. I quite like that one too. But what I like about these, especially with Peter Kenny and his he can just read like a list of ships. And and what they are doing, and you just go, yes, that is exactly what the ship would do. Like if it had that name, because the idea is the ships, they pick their own names, and they can never use enough gravitas, I think is the idea. Yeah, passing by and thought I'd drop in. A lot of these only take part in conversations. You would never actually see what they get up to, but they do have their interesting characters. Although I do think in this that the group
Oh, I've
of
just found on Wikipedia, I've just found the list of all the culture ship names.
I've
I'm just
just
going to
sent that
have a look
link.
at this now.
I've just sent that
So
link
if I
to you
don't say
in.
much in the next few minutes, you'll have to call me back to the conversation. Go on.
Nathan, I just sent you that list in Skype. If you just open up Skype, you'll be able to see it there. I just sent you that list. Anyway, the link to it. Anyway, but what I said about the ship mines is that they do take a big role in this book, not as much as say as in Accession or some of the other books, but their characters because this is a group which are all kind of doing the same thing and all interested in the same way. I did find their characters a little bit too much the same in this book. I wanted like an old matron kind of character to come in as a ship mind and put stuff right or take charge, but it wasn't. It was all kind of like teenage minds or slightly senile, quirky minds, even for ship standards.
Yeah.
So anything else, or do you want to get on to sort of talking about the thematic stuff that you mentioned before? Because I reckon I can take it back further. Shall I do this?
I just want to mention that it's called the Hydrogen Sonata. Do you want to just mention why it's called the Hydrogen Sonata? Because I found that quite interesting.
I will.
Even though it does come into the themes, because it's a life quest of the main female character, Cossant, isn't it?
Yeah, so Cossant, she plays the, if I can remember this. Yeah, no,
I'm
it
going
was.
to have to go back to the ship here. Where am
Yeah, it's called the antagonistic 11 string. I can't remember anyway. Let me see. Okay, so she plays the antagonistic undecastring, string, which is a harp which has 11 strings, and you play them all at the same time, and you
No,
think,
it has
well.
11 playable strings, and then it has many other
Yes.
strings and many other resonant strings and different sounding boards inside it, which also have to be controlled.
I was gonna get to that. So there's so many of these strings, and so she actually has four arms and four hands to be able to play along, which is good fun. And there's the mystery, the piece of music that she's dedicating the rest of her life until she sublimes into learning is called T.C. Falabella's 26th String Specific Sonata for an Instrument Yet to Be Invented. And that yet to be invented instrument was the antagonistic undecastring. So, what did you want to mention about this, or did you just want to say that's what the hydrogen sonata is? Because that's what it's.
Well, that's what the hydrogen. Yeah, and the other name for this, the shorter name for that long name that Luke just said, was it's called the Hydrogen Sonata, and it sounds awful, but it's the most difficult piece of music ever invented or ever composed, I should say. And so when somebody decides to learn it, they have to dedicate their whole life to to learning this piece of music until they've got it down. And the story starts with her playing this in an abandoned part of the city, because the city is mostly abandoned, ready for the subliming. And she's chosen it because it's because she wanted to give herself a life goal or a life task to do. And I think this comes down to the point, if you know that everyone's basically going to go to heaven in 5 years' time, and lots of people are being put into deep sleep stasis or whatever until that time, what do you do with yourself for those last 5 or 6 years?
Party,
or what do you do with yourself party. When, if you live in the culture and you're post-scarcity, what do you do yourself? Do you set yourself these arbitrary goals of whatever, or is there more to live with? I think this becomes a bigger theme when you're talking on the society level. What do you do when your society has made it? What's there left to do? Do you try and do things elsewhere in the galaxy, or expand your territory, or do you just decide to sublime and basically end it all? I think that's what some of the major themes of the book is.
Yeah, and this comes down into also what the culture's up to, because this is a culture book. It's not only about the Gazilt and about Cossant and the other people involved there in the political intrigue. You do get like, so what are these ships doing? They've got nothing to do, so what are they going to do? And they start doing stuff which they hope is good, and they, you know, but they're not going to sublime, but they've got to do something. So yeah, that kind of direction in life is a big thing.
And I think if you have something as powerful as the culture ships, who obviously get bored and restless very easily and have nothing much to do, they will just go off and find adventures and get themselves into trouble and things. And a lot of it, like I said, is where the ships are talking to each other, saying, you know, are we going to get involved in this? Is this something we need to get involved in? Are we just going to kind of walk away if it's nothing to do with us? I think that raises a few questions with a lot of science fiction, especially the kind of like the post-scarcity science fiction. What is it all about? Is there anything to work for, or do we need to invent this kind of this heaven or this hell to give us purpose, to give our life purpose in this life? So because there's going to be consequences, or there's going to be something happening later.
Well, that's what you get a little bit in this book. It's that they certainly talk about that in Matter, where you get the kind of uplift kind of idea that the like each culture or each new society or civilization kind of takes a few under its wing. And they also take
a few, mentoring kind
yeah,
of
mentoring
cultures.
And as they grow, they bring other people up with it. And I did notice that kind of the uplift kind of like, oh, yes, and this was our father race, and this was our father race, and this was our father. And you get these like family trees of societies, and Matter is about one of these societies which has been put into this shell, like this hollow Jupiter-sized planet. And it's like, okay, you guys, just go in there until you've grown up enough as a society, but that society is kind of infantilized in a way and just doesn't get out of its, like you say, its kind of medieval times. So it's only when they are given responsibility for something greater than themselves do they actually move on as, of course, those characters, and they move on as a civilization. They kind of start moving up to the next level, don't they, I think, in that book. I can't remember exactly, but that's one of the things that I took away.
Almost literally in that book.
Yeah.
Because they have to move out of the levels inside this planet to
to the next level or out. Yeah, so there is this like kind of leveling up kind of thing that you get there, and you did get that as well in Surface Detail. But this is what you're saying before about, hey, in Surface Detail you had hell, and this but that was like you said that in Surface Detail you got this fake hell. You get
The hell is a great concept for religions to invent to scare and keep control of the masses.
And that's exactly what that was. It was a purely invented fake hell to keep control of the masses.
Well, yeah, but this is almost like, but this one is when you die, you don't just go to your life just doesn't end, and this is in Surface Detail. Your life just doesn't end, and people believe you've gone to hell. You actually get transformed digitally, and your digital self then suffers. And
yes,
again, it's a way of keeping control of the population and society of these poor, cute little lizard beings or whatever they were in Surface Detail.
Little sheepy kind of things.
It was to keep control of them in the real life. And but then the flip side of this is used in this one, it's almost like the reward of this subliming that's happening in the future for the Gazilt is almost used in a similar way. It's like, oh, we all have to move towards this way, but people react to it in different ways. There's a big party which goes on for the last 7 years or whatever, or 5 years, where they get on this airship and circumnavigate the entire planet with a party going on the entire time. And that's some people's response to the fact that they're all going to sublime in a few years' time.
So what I wanted to bring these two books together again, and with previous books, is just to concentrate now on surface detail and the hydrogen sonata. In the surface detail, if you're good, you can go to heaven, a fake heaven, but if you're bad, you're sent to hell. What I really love about the hydrogen sonata in this book is that moral ambiguity, that it doesn't matter if you're good, and it doesn't matter if you're bad. And that's what you get. Like, even the worst characters in this book, you're like, well, they can't sublime. That would be dangerous for them. And then you think, well, the sublime doesn't really care. It just cares about, like, enough brain matter getting together or whatever it takes, you know, enough people moving together as one and a big enough civilization with enough technology to whatever it takes to sublime. It's not really gone into. But in with surface detail, you get a fake but real hell. And here you get a non-fake, like it's not like digitally created by, you know, and you're not, even though it is kind of technologically accessed in a way, but it's not heaven, but it's not hell. Because, in a way that it's not a reward and it's not a punishment, but it is like a goal. And
yeah.
And it makes the entire process of the afterlife not immoral, but like an amoral kind of guide in life. And the culture don't have that. Like the Gazilt had that. They have a goal, like you said, a goal to work towards, and it kind of brings this weird religious, military, yet peaceful society together. And the culture doesn't have anything like that. They don't have a goal to work towards, good or bad. They don't have any sense of morality in the end, except, and I think this is a point which I'm seeing more in these books, the culture's morality or conscience comes from the humans on board, because the ships don't need humans. And they say, oh, well, the humans are almost like pets now. We just look after them. We do fun stuff with them, but we don't really need them. But we keep them around because we think we keep. And I reckon the culture is keeping the humans around as its conscience. Yeah. It's like whenever you go
on a ship on this, which had a crew of like 12 people or something. Is that right?
Yeah. And they kind of voted to stay on or voted to stay on.
The people on board all voted for a certain course of action, and then the ship kind of went along with it.
Yeah. I think some of them didn't vote for it and left or something. But that's why I think you have in a book like, all of them, you often get like a human character, normally a human female character, plus a droid. Not a droid, a drone, plus a ship. And you've got the great mind of the ship, you've got the flexibility of the drone. Normally it's got weapons on board and it can go places where the ship can't. And then you've got the human, and the human isn't there really for guidance. Well, it kind of is. It's not really there for expertise, but it is there to do the right thing. It is there to be the conscience.
Yeah, to make those decisions, yes. And I think that the culture's morality seems to be very utilitarian, as in, reducing the reducing the pain to the minimum for the most amount of people, if that's the right way of saying it. But then the ships, if like, I think it was in... it was in one of them where somebody had volunteered to become the ship avatar for a week or something, or a month, and the ship basically tortured this guy for the whole time.
But that's what he wanted.
Well, he volunteered for it. What did he think I was going to do? And so, I definitely think there's a difference in morality between the ships and the actual people of the culture.
Yeah. So taking it back further away, what I really love about the culture series is that each one of them is talking about another big issue. of again, bring it back to use of weapons, that is about sort of like, you know, crime and punishment and living with guilt and, you know, kind of absolution.
Identity
as well. But then you got Look to Windward, which is again about these guys, like it's about characters wanting to commit suicide. You know, it's a space opera, but no, it's revolving around a guy who wants to commit suicide. And Matter is about, you know, one way that I look at it is the way like creationism and intelligent design. Like what happens if you're in one of these uplift kind of cultures and everything about you is completely fake, everything about you is technological, and that then moves into surface detail where like the biggest questions of religion and the afterlife is a technological solution that has been created for you. And then again into Hydrogen Sonata, where even like the whole society, like you say, is this post-scarcity. But it's about, you know, it's about these big issues of heaven and hell and life and goals in life, but in a way which is way, way, way more blatant than most books. And yet it's about starships shooting at each other and silly quests and trying to find people with no eyes.
There are some cool action sequences in this.
Yeah, I know, but
when they're stuck in the lifts at one point, I was just on the edge of my seat at that point. But yeah, you've got these underlying themes of these
really big questions.
where do you think Ian M. Banks can go from here with the next one? I know that you said after the one of the last reviews that you did of the Ian M. Banks novels, where you thought the ships might just decide to go off by themselves and decide that they don't need humans at all. Does this think he's going in that direction or going the opposite of that direction?
I think I want to see, like I said, I want to see the culture really tested against one of these other big civilizations. And I want the humans on board the culture ships to be against the ships, and I'm not sure how to do that, but I want to see that internal struggle. You know, one idea that I think I mentioned this in Surface Detail, because that's a lot about this fake war. You know, he's even abstracted war down into this computer simulation of war. And what I'd really love to see is like the two factions of ship minds fighting against each other, using their human agents or maybe their drone agents against each other, but maybe in an abstracted way, in the same way that war and hell were both abstracted into the digital realm in Surface Detail. I think that kind of thing, because you could bring back all of your favorite ship minds from the past, and you can bring back all the favorite, and you can actually like have it. And I don't mind that it's a simulation, because the good thing about a simulated war in Surface Detail, the outcome of that war was, will hell exist or not? And that's a big question. So I don't mind a computer simulation.
The stakes are high enough there, you mean?
Yeah, when the stakes are high enough, a computer simulation can be really interesting. And I really loved in Surface Detail, it kind of played out in the same way of Player of Games, where you get the same characters going into different types of war. And I'd really like to see that kind of thing. Like the ships are wanting to wipe out another society or another civilization or whatever it is. And the humans on board don't want them to do that, and they're capable of doing it, but the humans want them to stop. Yeah, I'm bringing out like ideas that I had for Surface, like a continuation of the series that I had in Surface Detail.
Well,
but bringing in the idea of the
simulation, there was one character in here which was a gazilt drone android who, from being turned off and turned on again, was convinced that the whole thing was purely a simulation
that was running, and he kept treating
everything as though it was a simulation instead of real life, and nothing that Kossan could do could convince him that this was actually real life. He said, well, that's what if everything was a simulation, that's what you'd be telling me.
And I was just waiting for the end of the book for him to sort of wake up, and they're like, well, you did really well in that simulation. He was like, thanks a lot. Of course, that's, you know, that's the Philip K. Dick ending to the book, where it turns out it all was just happening in a simulation for the purpose of testing this one military, the gazilt military drone. Well, it's not a drone, it's like a full
thing. That would have been good, though.
It would have been terrible.
That's the ending on the DVD. That's the DVD ending, isn't it?
The alternate ending. So yeah, you get that. Again, I don't think we've done too many spoilers, but we're just talking about our friends. But that was one of my favourite parts of the book. Again, it just goes, hey, remember Surface Detail when all these people were in a simulation? This is what can happen there. in that kind of thing. So anything else thematically? I think we've touched on quite a bit here, but yeah, what I'd like to see with where the culture is in the future, really like smash it against something, like really test it and have the humans and the ships go against each other in a way where only one of them can prevail, or only one of their goals can, you know, mutually exclusive goals for culture humans versus some ships and culture humans versus the majority of the culture ships.
Yeah. Though I get a feeling, though, most culture ships, if it came to that, just wouldn't be bothered enough to do anything.
But that's what I say, you need this external threat of some kind, you know, like an accession level threat.
I really like the idea of post-scarcity. And I like the idea that, far enough in the future, this post-scarcity society has worked out. Unfortunately, just bringing it back to reality, I think we're going to run out of jobs and money before we get to... We're going to be... Our society as it is now is going to become post-jobs before it's going to become post-scarcity. And I think we're going to have a bit of a difficult time until we get to the point where we have enough energy and resources to support ourselves post-jobs.
Why is that? Because everyone's going to have like food processors in their house, and or you're just saying that everything is going to become automated enough?
This technology is replacing jobs at a faster rate than jobs are going to be created at some point. So at some point in the future, there's just not going to be enough useful work and jobs to go around. But that point in time is going to come before we get to post-scarcity, which we can do, you know, if we get the energy problem sorted out. And once we have kind of free energy, we have free, kind of almost free food production and stuff. So everybody can live, although it won't be post-scarcity, but it will be enough to go around for everybody can have a decent level of, a decent quality of life. But I don't, that is going to come a lot later than the jobs run out.
Okay, that's an interesting
prediction. There's going to be a transition.
Are you a futurist now?
In between. Pardon?
Are you a futurist now? Are you being a futurist?
Yeah, I'm a futurist. I'm definitely a futurist. Well, I think about these things. But everybody keeps saying, oh, no, when this technology was invented, the jobs moved over here. And when that technology was invented, the jobs weren't in that industry, but they just moved over onto this other industry. But there is going to come a point where robotics gets to the point. It gets to a certain level, and AI and these other things, which I'm not one of these singularity people where, you know, I don't think there's going to be a singularity, but there's going to become a point where most jobs that most people do now will be able to be done cheaper and more efficiently with technology, and the jobs will run out before the resources catch up.
Is that like the unemployment singularity where machines will invent and take new jobs away from humans quicker than humans can invent jobs to new jobs that robots
the
can't do?
The unemployment singularity, I'll remember that one. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. But I, at the moment, I'm working on a project called Pigeon Post, which is to replace physical parcel deliveries, but use it, kind of route it through kind of internet protocol kind of things. At the moment, the computers are there, but the computer systems are adequate for doing it, but the robotics haven't caught up because it's going to need self-driving cars and a couple of other key kind of robotic developments. But it's the opposite of what it was like in the 1960s and 70s, where the physical robots were built. They were just waiting for the computer software to catch up with the physical robots that they're already built. And then when they did build, it replaced thousands, you know, like hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs. Was just if this one idea with Pigeon Post plays out, it could replace a couple of million delivery driver jobs. And when the Google cars turn up, it can destroy hundreds of thousands of bus drivers and train drivers and taxi drivers. All those jobs just suddenly disappear from the economy. And so you only need this to happen in 5 or 6 industries in the next 20 years, which is going to happen. And that's all the jobs gone.
Yes, and like you say, the you pass that event horizon where technology is replacing jobs quicker than humans can find them, and we might be on the edge of that now. I don't know.
Yeah, I think we're approaching that in the rich West. You know, that's a rich West problem, not so much a things will still have to be built somewhere.
You're actually going to say it's a first world
at some
problem,
point. But even those jobs of making and maintaining things will also disappear through technology. So
yeah, first world problems. So let's wrap up with this book here. What do you think? I always give star ratings. You don't have to if you don't want to.
Yeah, no, I listen to your star ratings. I mean, it does force you to kind of rank them and things.
Rated.
I would give it a solid 4 stars. I don't think it's as good as some of the other culture novels, just because I think, I'm just saying, I'm not disappointed by the ending, but I just, and it was very satisfying in a thought and kind of a philosophy way, but it wasn't so satisfying as a big kick-ass, fuck yeah kind of ending, which I know Ian and Banks can do.
But some of the best, consider Phlebas, his early books, he was known for just killing off all his characters at the end. And now he doesn't do that anymore. And it's like, oh, you've gone soft. It's like, you can't complain about him killing off all his characters. And then when he doesn't kill off all his characters anymore, say, oh, you're going soft. Or, you're not doing enough stuff. Anyway,
Was it Matter with the Jupiter-sized empty planet and things? Yeah, that you had, basically ships diving down through tunnels into the centre of the planet and, all this crazy stuff going on. But whereas this one was a lot more just manoeuvring and people manoeuvring each other. It was a bit more like chess than Duck Hunt.
But the point is, with what I didn't like about Surface Detail and Matter in these other books... it's not that I didn't like them, but the endings, it's too easy for the culture ships because they're up against stuff that it's like, don't worry guys, we've got this, bish bash bosh, told you we had it, it's no problem. Whereas in this book it's like, and then in the end they're like, actually let's just it's that kind of thing, and I like that.
They are their own deus ex machina.
Yes, they are, and in this case there isn't a deus ex machina, but there's this deus ex, not a machine of a god, kind of a Boy Scout meeting of the gods rather than
anyway, I'd say this is a solid 4 stars.
Well, I'd agree with you. I'm going to give it
very loose ratings based on your ratings.
For my 4 stars means that, hey, I thought it was 2.5 stars is purely average, which means I don't review that many books because I like to read good books. 3 stars is recommend it, but you might find stuff you don't like about it. 4 stars is solid book, would recommend anyone read it. And I think it's actually pretty good. It's a fun place. It's a fun book just in its own right, even if you don't know culture. But I would say go back and read some of the earlier culture books like Player of Games.
Yeah, don't consider Phlebas first culture book.
Yeah, I'd say go Player of Games, then consider Phlebas, which is set before Player of Games, which is good. Then go on to some Accession, Use of Weapons, Look to Windward, and then do Matter, Surface Detail, and the Hydrogen Sonata. Do those 3 in order, because I think they're thematically linked.
Yeah, definitely.
And in the same way that I think Consider Phlebas, Player of Games, and Use of Weapons are thematically linked, because they're about war and... conflict in a way that Matter, Surface Detail, and Hydrogen Sonata are much more about big issues. I say not so much big issues, but religious and consciousness kind of continuation issues and stuff. It's weird stuff. So yeah.
And what's your score then?
I'd say 4 stars. Yeah, similar.
Okay.
So that's it. Anything else you want to add? Because we've been going on, we've gone over an hour now. It's about an hour and 10 minutes now, so we should wrap this up.
Yeah, I'm sorry about this, everybody.
Just
let people know, I don't really do that much podcasting, though I do have a few projects. But you can find my blog at Nathan Ray, that's RAE, so that's nathanray.co.uk on the web if people want to check that out. And I do a lot of live streaming of events and videos and things that you can find there.
And so tangentially involved in the juggling world as well.
Yeah, so through Luke, I got some video juggling gigs and to video. So coming up in the next a few weeks, I'm going to be live streaming the show from the Leeds Juggling Convention in the UK, and then in January, Chock Fest, which is the York Juggling Convention, and then a few months later in April, I'm hopefully going to be live streaming the whole of the British Juggling Convention.
Oh, that's it. You did, haven't done that for a few years, have you? That would be good to get back to do that.
Yeah, I had to take a year off from that live streaming thing this year because I was having a baby. And I've also got a 7-week-old baby who's taking up lots of time at the moment as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, in case you're wondering, my identical twin brother's got a different name than me. He changed his name to Ray, which is funny. Someone who I went was in Africa with was called Chantal Ray, and it was funny because she messaged me on Skype the other day, and then you messaged me as well, and it's funny to see two people with Ray surnames,
Yeah.
and one of them's my brother, and one of them isn't related anyway. So yeah, I'll put a link to your blog and your different projects there in the show notes. So yeah, check it out on goodreads.com. You can follow me on goodreads.com or become my friend, and then I can see what you think about the book. I talk about it here, but not. Oh, also, I mentioned this before. Back in the past, I had this Audible offer because I'm a is it platinum subscriber or something like that? I've actually got lots of credits left over, but I'm getting through them now. And Juliana, my girlfriend, she's got an Audible subscription. Have you got an Audible subscription? So if you want to
Yeah.
support the podcast in some way, and it is actually pretty cool, if you want to help me pay for my Audible subscription, what you can actually do is go to this link. Let me just check where is the page. So if you this will be in the blog post as well. But if you go to www.audibletrial.com/SFBRP and sign up for any free trial, you get it like a 30-day free trial, and you can download any of these 10 like 100,000 audiobooks, you know, and like 20, 30,000 of them are science fiction and fantasy books and stuff. And I listen to a lot of these. I pretty much don't read paper books anymore. I listen to audiobooks and read ebooks on my phone. So my phone is now kind of taken over. But I really do enjoy the ebooks and the audiobooks. And most of the audiobooks that I listen to are from audible.com. And if you go there and sign up for a free trial, yeah, it actually helped support me financially. And what happened was I did a test run of these Audible ad slots, sponsorship slots, if you will, back in the summer, and they sent me money by check, by bits of paper. And so I took these bits of paper, and one of them was for like, you know, one of them was for like, you know, $30. So it's not like a massive, you know, contribution, but it was, you know, I was just
Yeah.
testing it out. And so I took it along, and the bank said, ah, yeah, it costs €20 per check because they're in American dollars and it's by check. And I was like, great, that is really not handy at all, because if you get $30, make it into euros and then take €20 away, I'm left with like €4 or something like that. So, so instead, we've moved me over, and I get the money from Audible via PayPal now. So it's actually coming in, and that's good, because then I can use that to buy books from Amazon, and yeah, and it's good. So if you want to support the podcast, check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP. There's a link in all of the blog posts on my podcast as well, on SFBRP.com. So check that out. I think that's
Yeah,
it.
and it's really worth doing once you've. I've built up quite a library now of science fiction audiobooks, and they're yours. You can keep them as long as you want. You know, even if you cancel your account with Audible, because I cancelled it last year for a couple of months when I was a bit short of money, and they're all still there. You know, I can download them whenever I want and listen to them. So
Yeah.
it's worth doing, even if you're just doing it for the trial
And also,
book.
it is DRM'd. You know, you can't just like email them to someone. You do actually have to enter it in. But there's nothing to stop you just giving like an iPod to somebody full of your entire audiobook. So, Juliana, that's why Juliana was going to read this, because she was going to, you know, just listen to it as an audiobook. Then she bought the ebook, because the sometimes all these ship names can be a little bit confusing if English isn't your first language. But yeah, it is possible to share the books around, no problem at all. So yeah, check out the Audible, and it helps support the podcast. And like you say, I'm not just doing this. Oh, I'm doing it for money. No, I do use this. You know, it's one of the main ways ways that I consume science fiction and fantasy and all the stuff that I review here.
And it's basically it's the only way I do it now. This and if you go to podiobooks.com.
Yeah, we mentioned those before. Those different series.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier on. There's some. There's lots of great stuff there, but I mean, there's some terrible stuff there as well. I should do a few links of science fiction and fantasy to avoid there as well. But no, I'm not going to do that now. So
okay, check it out.
Thank you very much for inviting me on, Luke.
No problem.
It's been fun having talking to you again.
And it's actually quite interesting to be on a podcast with someone where I'm the one who's having difficulty getting in a word edgeways, because normally that's normally my job, is to talk so much that other people can't join in. Anyway, so I was actually as a guest on the SFF Audio podcast number 187. I dropped it in the feed. Maybe you've listened to it already. Tarzan of the Apes, which is a really, really good book, a really, really good narration by a guy called David Stiefel, who is the his website's called The Burrows Guy, and so you can check out that. That's also as an audiobook and a podcast. So Tarzan of the Apes. Amazing, a really, really good classic book, really great narration, and the podcast that we recorded about it was good fun as well, so check that out.
Hang on.
What's up?
It's Tarzan isn't science fiction, is it?
No, but this was on the SFF Audio podcast, and they often do stuff...
What does SF stands for?
The podcast has evolved that they can talk about whatever they want. Edgar Rice Burroughs is a massive influence on the science fiction world with, you know, his Princess of Mars.
Princess of Mars
and loads of other stuff. And because David Stiefel had been on there before and they'd already talked about Princess of Mars and other books, he said, well, how about doing Tarzan? Yeah, it's more like a fantasy kind of world, but I would say there's some kind of science fiction elements in there, but it really isn't. It's much more kind of pulpy adventure stuff, but it's well worth reading. And that's why we did it as the SFF Audio.
I might check that out then.
Yeah, check out, really, go to... David Stiefel from the Burrows Guy, I think it's called, something like that. And it was a good podcast to do. So that's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.